So I plan to discuss an approach to string cosmology which I've collaborated on with several junior people. Stefan Alexander is here. Damien Neeson is now a postdoc at Syracuse. Scott Watson is a current graduate student at Brown. Timon Böhm is a graduate student at the University of Geneva. Dagny Kimberley is now a graduate student at Imperial, and Anupam Mazumdar is a postdoc at McGill. I first plan to create some controversy by giving some motivation why we should look beyond scalar field-driven inflationary cosmology. Then I'll try to isolate some general challenges for string cosmology, and then I'll go on to our approach, which is called brain gas cosmology, and you'll see what all of these words mean. Towards the end, I will then try to discuss the status and the challenges for brain gas cosmology. Just a warning, brain gas cosmology does not yet exist as a successful theory that goes from Planck times and produces our present universe. And I'll try to explain what needs to be filled in. And if I have time at the end, I'll address one approach to connect the very early universe within brain gas cosmology to our late time universe, inflation from brain gases. So first of all, the controversial part of the talk. So this is obviously not at all controversial. This is the beautiful WMAP data. I don't care how to turn it. Now, scalar field-driven inflationary cosmology, as you heard in the last talk, made this beautiful prediction for the cosmic, for the spectrum of cosmic microwave background anisotropies. So, angular quantum number L, intensity of the spectrum, and the red curve is one choice within the six-parameter family, which Slava mentioned, and these are the data points. And you see, even if you have six parameters that you can fit, you have a huge number of data points, and this is a spectacular success of scalar field-driven inflation. Our first quantitative model ever for structure formation gives us this great agreement with observations that came a long time later. So why should we look beyond scalar field-driven inflationary cosmology? So I have my list of reasons in increasing order of severity. So, and hopefully I'll motivate where string theory can fit in. So the first issue, the least important issue, is the question of the amplitude of the fluctuations. So if you just take a scalar field with a potential lambda phi 4, and you use the formalism which Slava described to calculate the mass fluctuations when these fluctuations with wave number k enter the Hubble radius at late times, then you get a number which is about 10 to the 2 times lambda to the 1 half. And you would like something like 10 to the minus 5. So there's some hierarchy problem. There's some small number that has to enter the theory of inflation in order to give agreement with observations. Now, I should also just mention that there's a new twist to the fluctuation problem, namely, in many scalar field-driven inflationary models with several scalar fields, more than one scalar field, there's a possibility of parametric amplification of super-Hubble cosmological perturbations during reheating. And in many models, this inevitably produces fluctuations which are greater than order unity today, independent of tunings of small parameters. And so that's a new twist of this fluctuation problem. So now, second problem, again, not that important. The transplanckian problem, well, Slava said that it's not a problem. Well, it's a window of opportunity. This is a space-time diagram of inflation, time-space, period of inflation where the Hubble radius is constant or approximately constant, post-inflationary period where the Hubble radius increases linearly. The great success of inflation is due to the fact that fluctuations which we observe on cosmological scales today start out on microphysical scales, microscopic scales, towards the beginning of inflation. But if inflation lasts more than 70 Hubble expansion times, then the physical wavelength of these fluctuations, which are measured today in the microwave background, was the wavelength was smaller than the Planck length at the beginning of inflation. So therefore, new physics must enter into the calculations of fluctuations. The results might end up not being sensitive, but they could be sensitive. And let me explain why they could be sensitive and in what way. So this is just an expansion of the previous plot. This is the inflationary period. We are looking at, for example, a scale which corresponds to L equals 10 in the microwave background sky. It starts out 70 E-foldings before the end of inflation. The physical wavelength was approximately the Planck scale. And if we want to start with initial values at the beginning of inflation, propagate forwards in time, we have three periods that determine the evolution of fluctuations on this wavelength. Period one is when the wavelength is smaller than the Planck scale, string scale. And during, if we imagine that during this time, during this period, some non-adiabatic evolution takes place, for example, due to discreteness of space-time. So if non-adiabatic evolution takes place in period one, then the duration of time that you will have this non-adiabatic evolution will be wavelength dependent, and therefore you could imagine that you would get deviations of the spectrum from scale invariance, an order one effect. So a toy model is given in this work, Ushuru Mata. So window of opportunity, we can test Planck scale physics in current observations. Now, the singularity problem, scalar field driven inflationary cosmology is incomplete in the same way as standard Big Bang cosmology is incomplete. In fact, Alex Vilenkin and Arvin Bode, and then Alan Guth, Arvin Bode, and Alex Vilenkin extended the Penrose-Hawking singularity theorems to apply to scalar field driven inflationary cosmology. And somewhere in space, there is a past singularity or a past geodesic incompleteness. So the theory is incomplete. But I think the Achilles heel of scalar field-driven inflationary cosmology is really the cosmological constant problem. We know that there's some unknown mechanism which renders some constant vacuum energy of fields, of quantum fields, gravitationally inert. How do we know that this same mechanism, which is unknown, as you all know, also renders the part of scalar field energy momentum, which looks like the cosmological constant, and which is the thing that's used to drive scalar field driven inflation, that it not renders that also gravitational inert? So, now, these were my provocative introductory comments. Now, why could string theory help? Well, you all know that string theory contains moduli fields. And you could imagine that the small parameters that are required to successfully get the right order of magnitude density perturbations could be associated with these moduli fields. Now, the transplanking window of opportunity, string theory is the theory that is supposed to describe Planck scale physics. We will have no black box to calculate fluctuations, but we will know how to calculate fluctuations. So the transplanking physics will determine the initial conditions and the initial evolution, and it will allow us to calculate fluctuations rigorously. One of the challenges, or one of the promises of string theory, at least for me, is that it should resolve cosmological singularities, and therefore address the singularity problem. And hopefully during the course of this meeting, you'll hear other ideas on the cosmological constant problem. I don't have any that are related to string theory. So now, string theory might give us a good realization of inflation, and that the results for standard cosmology are therefore reproduced via inflation. However, I think we should keep an open mind. It's possible that one does not get inflation from string theory, that one gets something else, which I'll call string cosmology. But in that case, one would have to reproduce all of the successes of inflation from this new theory. So now what I would like to do is I would like to kind of develop some of the key challenges for string cosmology. And for me, one of the key challenges is the dimensionality problem. Why do we live in three large spatial dimensions? Critical perturbative superstring theory is mathematically consistent only in 9 plus 1 space-time dimensions. Isn't this a fatal problem? Well, the traditional approach is that the extra dimensions are compactified in some way. The new approach is that we might live on a 3 plus 1 dimensional brain. But why 3 plus 1 dimensional? So my conclusion is that the key challenge for string cosmology is to come up with a mechanism which predicts why we have, why we live in three large spatial dimensions. And I would like to not to invoke the anthropic principle. Oh, it's my prejudice. So key challenges for string cosmology would be to resolve cosmological singularities, to predict the dimensionality, and also then to make contact with observations, either by providing a convincing theory for inflation or to yield an alternative cosmology which maintains the successes of inflation. And this star means that the fluctuations should be calculated in a mathematically consistent way, and the evolution equation should also be physically consistent. For example, the fluctuations for linearized perturbations should not be greater than unity. So the problem is that we don't know what non-perturbative string theory is. And I'm sure most of you in the audience know more than me about what this diagram means. Most work on string cosmology starts with one of these corners of this unknown non-perturbative version of string theory. And I will do the same. I will start with type 2 superstring theory. Now, the brain gas cosmology uses some essential stringy physics. It uses new degrees of freedom that you don't see in effective field theory description, namely the winding modes of strings. So if you take space, the background space, to be a torus of radius r, then there are momentum modes of strings, the oscillatory modes of strings, which give you the Hagedorn temperature, the winding modes. The winding modes will play a crucial role. And similarly, a new symmetry, which you don't see at the field theory level, namely T-duality, also will play a crucial role. So now there are also initial conditions in any conventional type theory. And I think one should discuss some of the rules. Brain gas cosmology is based on the idea of a hot beginning, like standard Big Bang cosmology, and one therefore expects a gas of strings and brains of all dimensionalities allowed by the microscopic theory. There's also the possibility of having a cold beginning, and in that case one would expect some special initial state to be determined by symmetry. And I think that's a starting point for pre-Big Bang cosmology and also for the ekpyrotic cosmology. This will be the hot beginning. So again, some approaches. Brain gas cosmology will use hot initial conditions. Pre-Big Bang, ekpyrotic will use special symmetric initial state. And brain world scenarios, well, I would like to see people address this question a little bit more in detail. Where does the particular setup come from? There's a good paper by Mahbub Manjubra and Ann Davis where, which shows that brain world scenarios could actually come from a hot initial beginning. So now let me turn to brain gas cosmology. So the theory, background, and initial conditions. And you'll see that the theory, that I should also warn you that the analysis is much too heuristic at this level. And towards the end, I'll tell you where the points are where the whole scenario could fall apart. But anyway, the theory, type 2 superstring theory, background is time cross 9 toroidal dimensions, and I will choose democratic and conservative initial conditions, namely all spatial dimensions the same size and Planck scale, and conservative, in a sense, similar to standard Big Bang cosmology, a hot gas, all degrees of freedom excited. So in this setup, we have key duality. And for fundamental strings, it means that the spectrum of states is invariant on the change in the radius of the torus to 1 over r in string units, and at the same time changing the momentum and the winding quantum numbers. Now, T-duality extends to brains, as Joe has shown. If you T-dualize all spatial dimensions, all 9 spatial dimensions, you turn a P-brain into a 9 minus P-brain. The gas, the type 2A brain gas, becomes a type 2 brain gas. But you can establish a one-to-one correspondence between the masses of states on this side and on this side. So for example, if you take a 4 brain on this side, you'll get a 5 brain on this side, but their masses are equivalent if you take into account the duality relation between the coupling constants. So this T-duality should extend from a duality of string gases to a duality of brains. So here's just the specific calculation. So now, the first use of T-duality is that T-duality may explain why there are no cosmological singularities. Let's look at adiabatic change in the radius of the toroidal dimensions. And let's look at the temperature of this string gas. You can show that the temperature obeys this duality symmetry. So if you start with R much bigger than a string scale, all of the energy in thermal equilibrium is in the momentum modes. As you approach the self-dual point, the energy will gradually leak into the winding modes. And as you decrease R closer to zero, the energy will be more and more concentrated in the winding modes. T of R equals T of 1 over R. The singularity in the mathematical background does not correspond to a singularity in the physical measurable quantity, namely the temperature. And you can also argue that the physical length, the length that an actual observer would measure, that it's invariant under the change r goes to 1 of r. And the argument is initially due to Kuhn and Werfer, myself, that for r greater than 1, you measure lengths in terms of the light states, namely the momentum modes. For r smaller than 1, you measure length in terms of the winding modes. And so if you measure lengths these two ways, you find that for r, the L will be the same as for 1 over R, the L tilde. So as you vary R adiabatically through the self-dual point, you'll find that the physically measurable length decreases to string scale, but then increases again. And obviously, if you have some dynamics that allows us to go back and forth, you'll find a bouncing universe. But this should all be based, followed up by some equations. So let me now turn to the equations that can describe the evolution. And the background equations which we use should be equations which are consistent with the basic symmetry, with T-duality. So we are using the action, the dilaton gravity action. So phi is a dilaton, R is a usual Ricci scalar. We define the logarithm of the scale factor by lambda. If we define the rescaled dilaton in this way, then we find that the action of the background is invariant under this duality symmetry. And the equations were worked out a long time ago by Gabriele, by Zeitlin and Waffer, and it's these equations. So these are the cosmological equations associated with this dilaton gravity action. You have the two equations which generalize the Friedmann-Robertson-Walk equations, plus the dilaton equation of motion. And this is the way that the matter sources enter into these equations. And I'll come back to this transparency. So, now let me mention something here already. So if you look at negative pressure, you see that from this equation, that negative pressure leads you to a confining potential for the scale factor, which is a new feature that you get in Dilthon gravity as opposed to Einstein gravity. And this fact that negative pressure induces a confining potential for the scale factor, that is key to the scenario. Okay, so back here again. So if we start out with our initial conditions, all degrees of freedom of all matter states excited, we'll have lots of winding modes. Winding modes have negative pressure. So you'll find that unless you can get rid of winding modes, there'll be a confining potential for the scale factor and there'll be no expansion. So therefore, in order to be able to produce a large universe, or to produce a universe in which some spatial dimensions are large, you'll have to get rid of the winding modes. So if you have a microphysical mechanism to get rid of the winding modes, then you'll have some equations that describe the energy transfer. So you can write down the energy density in the winding modes in terms of the number density of winding modes. This is the equation. And then there's the energy density of the string stuff which the winding modes decay into. In cosmic string language, it's the cosmic string loops. That, in terms of the number density of loops, this is the result. And the equations which describe the interaction between winding modes and the rest of the strings which do not wind are the same equations which were used in the cosmology literature to describe cosmic string dynamics. So in order to reduce the number of winding modes, you have to have winding mode, anti-winding mode interact. So therefore, the change of the number density of winding modes is redshift, and then the annihilation cross-section, which is proportional to the square of the number density of loops. So now I've shown you this set of equations which we are going to use, the background equations, plus the equations which describe the transfer of energy density between winding modes and other stuff. So our scenario is the following. So brain winding modes prevent expansion. P brains annihilate in at most DC spatial dimensions, where DC plus 1, the space-time critical dimension, is given by twice the world sheet dimensionality. So let's start with this brain gas. All brains in thermal equilibrium, all brains have associated winding numbers. The heaviest brains fall out of equilibrium first. Brains with largest P fall out of equilibrium first. There are no obstructions to getting rid of P equals 4 and high dimensional brains. But for P equals 2 brains, there are obstructions. And you can only expand 5 dimensions if you are fortunate enough that the annihilation of the brains is effective enough. But that turns out to be the case. Within these 5 dimensions, which start to become larger, there are still the string winding modes. And they will then only allow 3 of these spatial dimensions to grow large. So therefore, this scenario of brain gas cosmology seems to contain a possible solution of the dimensionality problem, starting from a scenario where all spatial dimensions start out to be Planck scale. You end up with only 3 dimensions large. But so far, these were only words. And let me show you that if you solve the set of equations numerically, which I showed you, that you then get results in accordance to that. So we've gotten rid of all of our brains, and we are just looking at the effects of string winding modes in the 3 dimensions which can possibly become large. So this plot shows you the time evolution of 3 quantities: winding number density, string loop density, and scale factor of the universe. We start out by hand in the expanding branch. So we start out at Planck scale, we give the universe a push in the expanding direction. Scale factor grows, winding modes are there, the winding modes cause the scale factor to stop, contraction to set in. Contraction sets in, the number density of winding modes increases, annihilations become very effective, loops are produced, number of winding modes goes down, and you are left in a finite time with no winding modes, the universe starts expanding again. So this is a scenario. Now, recent work. So I've showed you the dynamical equations which describe the three expanding dimensions. What happens to the six dimensions which are left behind? This is recent work with Scott Watson. So to discuss this, we took an anisotropic ansatz, where we have two scale factors, one describing the dimensions which become large, the other scale factor, the dimensions which are left behind. In that case, we have more equations of motion to solve because we have an anisotropic setting. We have the Einstein constraint equation, the dynamical equation of motion for both scale factors, plus the dilaton equation of motion. So again, what we are going to do is we are going to get rid of all winding. But first of all, let me take the first case. Well, we write down the energy, the pressure in the large spatial dimensions, pressure in the small spatial dimensions, in terms of the number of winding modes, number of momentum modes in the large dimensions, number of winding modes, number of momentum modes around the small dimensions. And then we see that if we start out with all winding and momentum mode quantum numbers equal, we basically find that we get damped oscillations of both radii about the self-dual point. If we get rid of the winding numbers in the large spatial dimensions, we allow the three dimensions to expand, and we have the equal number of winding modes and momentum modes around the small dimensions, then what we find is we find a damped oscillation about the self-dual point for the radius of the small dimensions. And again, I have one graph to show this. So we start the radius of the small dimensions off, displaced from the self-dual point, and we find oscillations about the self-dual point. So it seems that there's radial stabilization due to the winding modes. So challenges. Are the three dimensions which become large, are they isotropic? Well, the answer, as shown in a previous paper by Scott Watson and myself, the answer is yes. There's an automatic isotropization mechanism within the large spatial dimensions. If you have one dimension which is smaller than the other dimensions, then there's more efficient annihilation of the winding modes in that dimension than in the other ones. So that gives rise to a mechanism which tends towards isotropy. And this was this can be verified by solving the equations. Now, I was using toroidal backgrounds. Can one generalize the analysis to backgrounds which are not toroidal? And there the Columbia group, Richard Easter, Mark Jackson, Brian Green, did some very nice work where they've extended the analysis to orbifolds, and they've shown that for certain orbifolds, even though there are no topologically conserved winding numbers, the winding modes live long enough to effectively give you the separation of dimensions. You can also start in 11-dimensional supergravity, and again, the Columbia group has done a lot of nice work, and the story is less clear-cut. You find separation of dimensions, but not in as nice a way, as general way, as you get in our corner of modular space. And finally, the big issue, big question mark for me, is the homogeneity of the internal dimensions. The internal dimensions are held together by the winding modes. Our physical dimensions are growing. So in all physical dimensions, the separation of the winding modes is becoming big. How do we know that they are not disastrous inhomogeneities, as opposed to anisotropies, in the internal dimensions? So this is work which we are beginning now. And just a warning is that it's possible that our nice, at least what I consider nice ideas, will break down because of these uncontrolled instabilities. But there are possible ways. But there are possible ways to get around it, which I'd like to discuss with participants. Then another big problem is, how do we get a large universe today? Well, I've told you that there are three dimensions which start expanding, and they expand forever. But you know that without inflation, it is not possible to take a Planck scale universe and make it large enough. That's part of the flatness problem of standard Big Bang cosmology. That was also one of the problems of initial ekpyrotic scenario, where you started out, where there was no reason to start out with an infinite plane as opposed to a Planck scale torus. So it looks like if we want to successfully connect with observations, we do need inflation to take all three dimensions, which we've made free of Wiening numbers, and put them and make them large enough. Also, we need a mechanism to generate fluctuations. Well, if we have a successful inflation, we will get this. So, can we get inflation from brain gas cosmology itself? That would be nice if everything would come out of the same ideas. So I'd like to conclude by telling you some ideas how this could work. It's brain gas inflation. And the key idea is inflation from stabilized embedded defects. So this part of the talk has very little to do with string theory. It is something that is also very interesting in field theory in its own right. So let me, probably not many of you know what an embedded defect is, so let me define it. An embedded defect is a solution of the field equations of a quantum field theory, which looks like a defect in the sense that it has confined potential energy, confined in a plane, in a line, in a point, but it's unstable in the vacuum, as opposed to stable in the vacuum, like a topological defect would be. So, and it is a topological defect of a theory, which you get from the theory you are considering by freezing certain degrees of freedom. So those are the defining relations for an embedded defect. Now, embedded defects exist in the standard model of particle physics. They exist in the electroweak theory. The electroweak Z string is an embedded defect. They exist in low energy QCD. The pion string is an embedded defect. An example of an embedded wall is the following. You take a system with two real scalar fields with a typical Mexican half potential, and you set up a configuration which has a planar symmetry and which goes from one vacuum to the other for chi equals zero over the hill. So this is a defect-like configuration, it's a wall-like configuration, but in the vacuum it's unstable due to chi excitations. Now what we discovered a few years back is that in a plasma, in the plasma of the early universe, as long as the quantum numbers of these two real scalar fields are not the same, that then there is a natural stabilization mechanism of these embedded defects, plasma stabilization. This is the original reference. How does this work? Well, the easiest way to view that is that due to the covariant derivative terms, which are different for phi and chi, if you have different quantum numbers of phi and chi, you get different plasma masses for phi and chi, and that therefore the vacuum manifold gets lifted. So let me show this to you in detail. So let's assume that you have a gauge field, which is in thermal equilibrium, for example, the photon field, and one of these scalar fields is charged with respect to the photon field, the other one is neutral. Like happens in the electroweak theory, and like happens in low energy QCD. Then if the only field in thermal equilibrium is a photon field, then this term will give rise to a T square chi square term in the effect of Lagrangian for phi and chi, and that will lift the potential in the chi direction and therefore render the electroweak strings or the low energy, the pion strings stable. So now, what I would like to do, the connection with brain gas inflation might be the following. Let's consider also the unstable brains, which the theory admits. And let's hope that the matter fields which are excited on the brains, that they give rise to plasma masses which stabilize these unstable brains while the energy density of the plasma is large. Then you could hope that you would get inflation induced by these unstable brains. When these unstable brains decay, inflation would terminate. That might be a way to get inflation directly from brain gases. So if you take P brains in D dimensions, D spatial dimensions, and you demand acceleration, you find that you need P to be D minus 1 in order to get an accelerated equation of state. We are interested in the three dimensions which are becoming large, therefore we need two brains to be able to stabilize, to be able to give us acceleration. So therefore we go back to the old idea of Zeldovich, Kobzarev, and Okun of domain wall driven inflation. Domain walls in three dimensions can give us inflation, but they will give us inflation with the wrong spectral index. So we are part of the way towards connecting brain gas cosmology with our universe. Namely, we do have a mechanism to get inflation from brain gases, but it's not yet good enough because it doesn't give us the right large-scale fluctuation. Also, this period of inflation might be too short. So the scenario might now be the following. You start with democratic conservative initial conditions in type 2b string theory. The dilaton is free. In this stage 1, our mechanism works. The string winding modes give you the separation of dimensions. They allow three dimensions to become large. The other six remain string scale. And then we assume that some miracle happens and the dilaton is fixed. In this case, we go back to the effect of Einstein gravity description. We then use the unstable two brains, which are stabilized by plasma effects. That will give us a finite period of inflation in the three large spatial dimensions, which would then give us a large enough three-dimensional universe. It would solve the flatness problem. However, what gives us the nice spectrum of fluctuations which we observe? And there we would have to invoke yet another miracle or yet more fields. For example, we could invoke the curvaton scenario or just other fields in addition to the fields which I've used. So you see that there are at least two miracles which I needed to invoke in order to actually produce a large enough three-dimensional universe. So I think at this point I should conclude. Hopefully I've motivated a democratic conservative approach to string cosmology. We are in the bulk. Brain gases in the dilaton gravity background give rise to a separation of dimensions. Three dimensions become large, six become large, assuming you have a hot small beginning. So the successes of this scenario would be non-singular. It would explain the dimensions. But the problems are that this description is much too heuristic. For example, we have a separation between background and brain matter, and the ultimate theory should not have this separation, it should be unified. Even if you accept this too heuristic description, there are instabilities in the scenario which are not under control. The anisotropies are under control, but not the inhomogeneities. And we have not yet made successful contact with late-time cosmology. So, therefore, there are large challenges remaining for brain gas cosmology. But hopefully some of you are convinced that it's an interesting starting point. Thanks.
So I have a couple of comments. First of all, with the stabilization mechanism, it seems that this is really relying upon having the dilaton, because tension of the winding modes is only effective for preventing expansion because it's dilaton gravity. So once you've reached a lower energy regime where the dilaton stabilized, I don't think that this can stabilize your extra dimensions. You're going to have some other stabilization mechanism. And if I may, I'll just make my second comment. So then this comes back to the idea of trying to explain the hierarchy between dimensions. Seems to me the only way that can work is if you're rolling through this landscape of vacuum states, and finally you get to low enough energies that you have to settle down into one of them, and that's really determining at the end, or that's stabilizing the size of your extra dimensions. You need some stabilization for the small dimensions. But then once you get there, you have to ask yourself, why did I land in just such a place that my large dimensions are not stabilized? Because it seems that generically they should have been also.
Now, I guess I disagree with the second part. So I certainly agree that once some mechanism has happened, some miracle has happened, and the dilaton is fixed, we do need to prevent the extra dimensions, which are now many, many orders of magnitude smaller than the three dimensions which we live in. We do need an extra mechanism to prevent them from becoming too large. So that part I agree with. But you see, from this point of view of a hot initial gas, I think we have a mechanism which gives us a separation of dimensions. So we don't have to explain that. But I see someone.
You say that this model is non-singular, but you say it has a hot beginning. So what?
You see, we've chosen a time which we call t equals zero, and we start with with all of the initial radii to be string scale. Now we can take our equations and go forwards in time and backwards in time. And you see that what you get is a bounce at that point, at the point t equals zero. Now, I'm not going to tell you what happens if you go far away into the past from that bounce.
I've got a question about one of your motivations having to do with non-singular initial conditions. Why is it that inflation requires singular initial conditions? For example, you could start from a metastable. You could tunnel to a situation where the inflaton is at the top of some potential, which then rolls down. And if that is the case, you don't have to have necessarily started from a singularity. Am I wrong?
Okay, so let me just make clear what I said. I said if the action, we are in 3+1 dimensions, if the action is scalar field plus Einstein gravity, then the statement is that there inevitably is an initial singularity somewhere in space, or a geodesic incompleteness.
But the initial condition
which began inflation might have been a tunneling event from some other minimum, let's say. And in that case, you won't just extrapolate back to a singularity, I think.
The arguments are
classical.
It could be, so I don't.
May I give a comment on, well, just attracting attention to the work by Ehrenfest of 1917, where he, I think, explained three-dimensionality of our space using entropic principle, even though it was not called entropic principle at that time. He just noticed it, that if you consider just normal Newtonian forces acting between bodies, then only in three dimensions these new forces lead to existence of stable planetary systems. In fact, if he would use general relativity, he would find that even in two and one dimensions, there are no gravitationally bound systems at all. But in four dimensions and five dimensions, etc., they are unstable. Atomic systems are also unstable in dimensionality larger than three, and in the dimensionality smaller than three, there are no free electrons, etc. So things like that, and the fact that we would not fly on the plane to Santa Barbara being in two dimensions, shows, I think, that we must live in three, if compactifications with three dimensions are possible somewhere in the stringy landscape, and if inflation can do these parts of the universe sufficiently large. So then, if we find it, then we solve the problem. We don't need to prove that they are better.
Yes, but so I hear what you're saying, Andre, and I don't object to what you're saying, but I would like to explore the possibility of getting three spatial dimensions from without having to appeal to the anthropic principle. If we do not even need it, it would be even nicer.
Let's see. You mentioned that when the Columbia Group investigated this, brain gas cosmology in M theory, they didn't find that it worked so well. They didn't get a clean separation of three dimensions being large and the rest small. So do you attribute that to just the different brains that are present in the two theories, or is it also different initial conditions or other assumptions that were different in the calculations?
The key difference is that we start out in 9+1 dimensions with, so in our case, from the supergravity point of view, from the 11-dimensional supergravity point, we are treating one spatial dimension completely different. And that then gives rise to this to the tenuality of the background. So I think this is the key to the difference. Then maybe Mark wants to say something about that?
The reason we found it didn't work so well is that you want the microphone?
By the way, this is Mark Jackson for people.
Hi. The reason we found it didn't work so well in M theory was because we took into account the holographic bound, that you just can't put an arbitrary number of brains into a small region. It would turn into a black hole. And so if there aren't many brains, it's not really a brain gas, so there's not enough wrapping to cause this hierarchy.
Yeah, I mean, I would add to what Mike said that if we ignore the holographic bound, then we did see ranges of the initial density of brain gas in this universe where we got interesting dynamics out of it, where we could see a universe where you'd naturally wind up with three directions that weren't wrapped by brains at late times. But once we did impose the holographic bound, then that chunk of the initial condition space was ruled out. So it's the combination of the holographic bound plus the understanding of the dynamics that we developed that makes us kind of pessimistic about the implementation of this scenario in the specific case of the 11-dimensional supergravity.
In this 10-dimensional case that you consider, you would also have to consider the possibility that the dilaton varies, right? And if
the dilaton dynamics, we don't fix the dilaton.
That's right. So if I remember correctly, didn't Banks and model show that when you consider this all the moduli, then it is possible to have spaces that cannot be dedualized or dualized to large volume. So you made the argument that the evolution could be completely non-singular.
But so I think you are getting now at the point that you are taking into account inhomogeneities, which are other moduli fields.
No, I'm not talking about inhomogeneities. I'm just I'm asking about the statement that you could always dedualize or you dualize to a situation where all dimensions are large, to a weakly coupled situation, right? And Tom maybe can correct me. Didn't you show that?
When we first learned, when we first learned, I investigated all of the possible asymptotic
shout.
Asymptotic regions of toroidal moduli space in M theory, and some of them can be dualized to weak coupling large radius regions, and roughly half of them can't, and don't have any interpretation either as weakly coupled string theory with large dimensions or 11-dimensional supergravity with large dimensions. So those regions of moduli space are much more mysterious, and you just can't apply these kinds of arguments to them.
Okay, so we need to talk about
maybe
that.
Maybe that's where your demographic assumption enters, because maybe these were very anisotropic Casimirs.
Well, it's roughly half of the asymptotic regions of moduli space. So I think they're no more anisotropic than.
I think inflation is non-singular in the same way as you say your beginning is, because if you take the Sitter space sort of at the close the Sitter space at the midsection of the sort of neck of the Sitter and put a scalar field on the top of the potential, you can evolve it forward or backward and you will have non-singular evolution. Of course, the trouble is that if you you have a very weird evolution in the past, right? Because you're evolving it backwards in time rather than forwards. If you start from a generic, other than extremely special initial condition in the past, you'll have a collapse rather than move to the expanding phase. So I think the same would be true in your case. You're basically starting your model at a finite time, and you can sort of evolve it back at a moment of time symmetry, basically.
But so at the level of the homogeneous equations, we do not depend crucially on the exact symmetric initial condition. All we need is we need to have energy transfer between momentum modes and winding modes allowed. In that case, there's a force that prevents you from reaching R equals zero, and there's a force which prevents you from going to R equals infinity.
Any more comments, questions? No. Okay, now let's thank all the speakers.
Thank you. Thank you.